Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, my buddy, my pal, from the band Panthers, from the band, newly reformed band, Orchid, from the new solo project, Jason Green and the Jerks, and the new proprietor of a fantastic bar here in Toronto, Doc's Green Door Lounge. Jason Green returns to the show for this is a raw conversation. This is just two people laying it all out there, and I'm excited for you to hear it. 1 second, because first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and normally show producer. Well, no, always show producer, normally guest booker, but I could handle booking this one all on my own. Tristan Abraham, thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at @LeftForDamian. There is a TikTok page, a Facebook page, an Instagram page, and a YouTube page for Turned Out of Punk. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast that we do. I think it's safe to say now, twice a week. I'm back to doing them twice a week. And spread the word. You can find out about the stuff I'm doing in my band. We are currently on tour. Go over to fuckedup.cc and check out where we're playing with Superchunk if you're on the west coast of the United States when you hear this episode. I think when you hear this, we got a few more dates. Pretty sure. So see us on the road. Talk to me about this episode. Talk to me about all these episodes. Come out and hang out. Also check out fuckedup.cc for records and merch and all sorts of goings on with the band. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, as I said off the top, someone who's accomplished a lot since he got to Toronto, and has accomplished a lot before he came to Toronto, but Jason Green, someone that I've always been a big fan of, certainly someone who has had a lot of different places in music over the years, a bit of a Zelig type character showing up in all sorts of different places. Probably the only guy in the world that was asked to join Hatebreed that is also part of LCD Sound System. I think I'm fairly safe in saying that. Okay. Anyway, Jason is someone who has got a lot going on, as I said off the top. Got a new bar, Doc's Green Door Lounge here in Toronto. Reformed the Orchid, which is something that, we talk about a lot in this episode. And got this great solo record produced by James Murphy from the aforementioned LCD Sound System. And it is released on DFA Records. I love this record. It kind of reminds me of like old Cleveland stuff. You hear it. Old New York kind of dancey disco punky stuff. You'll hear it. And it's available to listen to on all social media platforms. No, all streaming platforms. I'm sure it's on some social media platforms too. All right. I'm not going to yammer on anymore. Check out tour dates for Orchid, where they're playing. They've got a bunch of shows announced. A bunch of them are already sold out. You can also find out about other stuff that Jason Green is up to on social media. Find him at thisjgreen on Instagram.com. And if you just search this stuff. But check out Jason Green and the Jerks. That's available on all those streaming platforms that I mentioned before. All right, I'm not going to yammer on anymore. Check out Jason's bar. Check out the records. Check out all the stuff. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Jason Green on Turned Out of Punk. Jason, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're in the basement again.
Yeah. How many times can I be in the basement?
Probably too many for you. For me, never enough.
Oh, no, I love it. I love the basement.
There's always interesting stuff to look at.
That's for sure. Yeah, I'm always staring at your demo tapes.
I definitely have some demo tapes on display. There's like an aesthetic quality to them that I'm glad they have, because right now my last tape deck broke. And so it is the worst format.
It's a bad format. But I do find myself looking and seeing ones that I also have, and then seeing lots that I don't, being like, I think I need those demo tapes. And I haven't had a working tape deck probably about 15 years.
Have you ever seen that? I think it's like a Thurston Moore photo where he's like in a wall, in front of a wall of tapes. I think it was like...
No, I don't know if I've seen it.
I don't know why it's very obscure. As I'm saying that, I'm like, maybe you've seen this photo. But anyway, he's in front of this wall of tapes, and I've always thought, like, that was my dream, is to have, like, a wall of tapes. And
well, you're getting there.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, definitely. My kids will have a lot of garbage to deal with.
Yeah, that's the only gift you can give them is now you have to throw this out.
Yeah, I really do feel like all these things where I'm like, well, this is an amazing investment at $25 for this, like, random old demo tape. Yeah. They're going to be like...
Yeah.
Pennies on the dollar at best.
It's only going to appreciate in value, kids.
Yes, absolutely. There will be...
The riffraff demo.
Well, welcome welcome back to the show.
Thanks, man. Glad to be back.
Well, I'm very excited to have you back because your new record is fantastic.
Thank you.
And you've got a bar now?
Yeah. So, I guess when I first moved from Brooklyn to Toronto... you know, I left behind like my whole social circle, my work. And I moved up here and I had nothing going on. Like I was basically just like going to Home Depot and doing laundry and running errands. Didn't really know anybody. And so I started putting some irons in the fire, thinking maybe one thing would click off, and then everything happened at the exact same time. So, yeah, now I've just opened a bar in the Junction in Toronto called Doc's Green Door Lounge.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
In a few short months, you've accomplished more than I've accomplished in 40-plus years.
I don't know if that's true.
You put out a solo record.
Yeah.
You put out other solo stuff, too, but I mean...
To be fair, that the A-side of that... Oh, no, I'm sorry, the B-side... The B-side of that record was recorded during the Obama administration. So that's been around for a long time. We've been just trying to figure out, kind of finish the record and figure out a home for it and all that stuff. So, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm happy it's out. I'm happy it's out.
Do you feel like the same sentiment about the B-side? Because the B-side's kind of cutting. And, you know, there was a... I don't know. For me, it feels like that was a different mentality than now.
That I have personally,
I don't
or just for
personally.
The world,
for
in the
world,
world.
I mean,
yeah, maybe. I mean, I was at that time. I have a friend named Marcus who does a project on DFA called Shit Robot, which is great, by the way. If people haven't heard it, you should check it out. He has a new record that just came out as well on DFA. But he was putting out a record, and he produces the music, but he doesn't. He's not a singer or anything, so he likes to have guest vocalists. And he asked me to do vocals on a song. And he was like, yeah, I just kind of want you to be ranting about it. And he gave me some references, you know. So I wrote this long, kind of ranty song and then sent it to him. And then he cut stuff out and cut it together. Came out great. We made a music video for it that's really fun. That's on YouTube. And so a lot of this stuff that he cut became the lyrics to the B-side of, it's called I Need Love. Of the new 12-inch. So there's a lot... He is a DJ. I'm a DJ. And there was this feeling at the time that everybody on Earth was a DJ. And I think I had... you spend enough time in that world, it's easy to get jaded with anything. But I had a line that said, it's not very cool to be a DJ in your 40s. And he's in his 50s. I'm in my 40s. And he's like, this isn't going in the song. And I was like, okay, fair enough. And then I put it in my own song and then kind of built around that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think we got a review on Brooklyn Vegan, and it said something like, being like a dickhead wise ass has always served Jason Greenwell as a vocalist or something like that. Something along those lines. So, yeah.
Because it played to me almost like nostalgia for that time when there were too many DJ nights, when everyone was a DJ, where you could go out and just... club hop in a way that doesn't seem as viable now, like where now you go out and sit in one place and kind of like maybe because we're just I'm older too.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I mean, it's definitely like DJ culture is still really huge and vibrant, and there's lots of, I mean, there's young people doing it all over the place all the time, and but where the bar that I'm at, it's in this sleepy neighborhood called the Junction, and there's a warehouse behind that has like raves every night.
Yeah.
I mean, like, people are, it's still, it's still happening.
Kids will find a way, but I think it's harder now in terms of finding venues to do stuff.
Could be. Space, I mean, I don't know. I always, I found this, I had that feeling in when I was in Brooklyn, and I was kind of like, oh, there's all the venues have closed, like all the kind of independent venues. Then you realize that there's, of course, kids are fucking throwing shows that I don't know about. Like, why would I know about it? I'm an old man. Mm-hmm. And they're still doing it. I mean, this is like hardcore shows or parties or, you know, DJ nights. And I mean, listen, if you go, I can't speak to Toronto as much culturally, but in Brooklyn, you know, you can't throw a rock without hitting a DJ still. I mean, everyone's kind of a DJ. And it's not even really... Yeah, I don't know. There's an affection to it, and I'm also kind of making fun of myself because I've spent many, many years DJing since I was like 18. It's pointed. The knife is pointed towards me as well.
Yeah, I know. I get the knife's pointed towards you, but I think just in terms of aging, I think you brought up earlier 40, and you know your friend obviously being 50. I think there's a difference in the way what you do is appreciated at 40 and 50. I had a friend one time call me, and he probably doesn't want me to say their name, but a friend called me one night and was just like lamenting the fact that no one's going to take us seriously in our 40s, and then in 50s, people come back to you and start respecting your work again.
That's funny. I've never thought about that. I've been asked a few, like in podcasts before, you know, what new music are you listening to? And my answer is always the same, where it's kind of, if you're over 40, no one should give a shit what you're listening to.
But John Peel was able to kind of keep it.
No, of course, there's always people that can do that stuff. I mean, Marcus, yeah. Shit Robot's a great example. I mean, he's incredible DJ. The Too Many DJ guys, James Murphy, all these friends of mine, Pat Mahoney. I mean, these guys are all older, amazing taste, great selectors, so fun to watch play. I mean, you know, it doesn't really, I was being a wise ass, I guess is the short answer.
You know, I'm fascinated by like how like you do eventually age out of the zeitgeist of what this is. And at the same time, you have to find your own place.
Like of like dance music culture or just music culture?
Music culture in general.
Yeah.
And like finding your own place to produce it and still like, obviously there's like a drive to make stuff that keeps people doing it. But at the same time, like also finding where you fit into the world of it.
Yeah. And I think I've personally never had never really had a careerist attitude about music ever. So I kind of just would go where my whimsy would take me from project to project, just whatever I want to work on that seemed cool. And I've had things that have done decently well, and I have things that have eaten massive shits that no one cared about at all, you know? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there's, I think you can't be too calculated about it. You just have to, I think for me, it's such a big thing with music is authenticity. If it feels authentically coming from that person, even if it's not for me, I feel like it can find a home with some people. So it's going to resonate with somebody if it feels true to the person making the thing. If it feels like you're trying to get something going, like cook something up, mm-hmm. then people, it's a little harder, I think. But, I, you know, not to keep going back to the DJ stuff, but I also came to mind DJ Harvey, who's one of the great DJs of all time. He's still going. He's still amazing. And, you know, he's never done what's popular. And but people love him, you know? And I think there is something to that. Just being like, I remember I was DJing, I was opening up for LCD, DJing I had to DJ between sets. So I started off, I did my first of two. I just wasn't working. I was kind of like chasing the crowd around, trying to like make him happy. And then I came off stage and I was like, man, that sucked. And James is like, he's like, just play songs you like. He's like, who cares? And I was like, oh, that's good advice. It's like you really need to trust your taste. And if you start questioning it, I think that's when you get into some trouble.
I think as a DJ, you can age. There's a path for aging gracefully that's not necessarily there in rock.
No, for sure.
Certainly not punk.
But you definitely, yeah, no, certainly not punk. But, I mean, you see it. but it is tougher.
It's tougher. Yeah. There's people that do it, obviously, yeah. But it is.
It's a young person's game.
Well, because you have to put yourself out there, and I think DJs benefit from being slightly mysterious.
Yeah.
I was watching interviews with, I'm not going to talk shit about the actual DJ, but I was watching interviews with a very popular DJ that just for some reason showed up on my phone, because obviously it's listening to me, and it probably will now feed me more of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking how the demystification of this person is just so much to their detriment, because... Yeah. You're afforded the luxury of being mysterious as a DJ.
Well, I mean, I had that experience when I watched that Sparks documentary. Mm. Like, they were such a mystery to me. I didn't know anything about those guys. I liked those records a lot. And then I watched the documentary and I left it being like, I don't think I like Sparks. Like, I know too much now. Like, they're not interesting, you know. Kiss without the makeup is not quite as fun as Kiss with the makeup on, you know.
But this era is all about Kiss without the makeup.
Well, there is so much, and I think that comes a lot from, I think, from SoundCloud, YouTube, people having direct access to artists. And what a lot of people want is they want to be able to see themselves being able to do, I'm just a regular guy. I'm nice. I'm a normal person. And like, that's the last thing I want from an artist.
But they're not too. It's still that augmented version of reality that we were getting from, I guess, reality TV, but we're getting from Kiss when they're on stage with all that makeup on. Like, my kids will watch these YouTubers or these YouTube families do these things, and they'll be like, oh, it's just great watching a normal person doing normal things. It's not normal when you watch it. It's like, no. That's lighting. They definitely have lighting going on. And they're doing multiple takes of this shit.
Yeah.
Like, this is not real, but yet it's being presented as being real, which Kiss wasn't. Was saying this is a fucking fantasy.
Yeah. And then, you know, you think of shows like The Voice or something, which I think was sort of maybe a canary in the coal mine of this whole phenomenon of just like, hey, I'm just a regular guy off the street, you know? Yeah. And you think about someone like David Bowie on The Voice, no one would turn their chair around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just... It's a natural progression of the way things go with more access when things get democratized. There is an argument to be made for gatekeepers. You know what I mean? Mm. There is an argument to be made for people with taste choosing artists who are interesting or weird and having faith in those artists. It still exists, but, you know, I mean, we live in a world where, like, Ed Sheeran, I mean, sounds like, the music sounds like running water. Fine. I can see some appeal to, it's, you know, pop music. Who would fuck Ed Sheeran? You know what I mean? I'm sure people do. But it's just not, like, to me, he's not a rock star. He's not a star.
Well, it's like what you like gone wrong, where there is no popular sphere anymore. And I was thinking about this. I was looking at a friend who has really good taste in movies, their top 10 movies, because I'm so fucking out of touch on film, even more than music. And I was like, looking at their list, and I'm like, really? That's like Magic Mike 3 is even like
in the conversation,
And I love bad movies, like, I get off on watching bad movies, but that was like just unwatchably, awkwardly bad.
Yeah, that was a very bad film.
It was, they had a Zoom call as one of the
well, I just recently rewatched The Net with Sandra Bullock, and it's like tense typing. Such a major plot point in that film. It's weird. There is this sort of flattening of culture that's happened. But, you know, there's always stuff in the corners. There's always weird things to find. It's just getting a little bit... And there was weird stuff in mainstream culture. There was outsiders in mainstream culture. I mean, like, Sylvester is a great example. Outselling the Stones, you know? This giant, you know, trans person performing these crazy disco songs, you know, very, like, not really defining their sexuality, not defining it, but, you know, it just, and then they were the number one on the pop charts. That was like in the culture, and now there's just not as much stuff like that. There's not as many weirdos making really, really popular music.
I think there are, but it's now you can subsist in your own little fan base. Like little Uzi Vert is making weird ass music. It's not really what I listen to.
Oh yeah. Well, but
it's weird.
Hip hop has always been, I think, a place where you can find the most interesting stuff that touches the popular culture sphere. And I think the things you find that young kids respond to in that world, there's a lot of like that. What's his face? That I'm going to get the first, like Kosher, that dude. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a fucking weirdo. And it's cool. And it sounds like, doesn't sound like other stuff. You know, there's so many things like that. I talked to my nephew he's 15. He has no interest in punk music or anything like that, but he's interested in hip hop, and he'll be listening to like weird SoundCloud stuff. That's really abrasive, aggressive, strange. And that I think that has been the case for a long time. Like when I was growing up, the regionality of hip hop was so real. Like mm-hmm. You'd find these little micro scenes. It's almost like when you think about how metal is classified in these little micro genres. Hip hop was like that too. You'd find these different tiny little scenes, like in one neighborhood of Atlanta, they played this kind of music, you know? And I think that that's still kind of happening. And I think that's interesting.
I think that hardcore, you had that too. A regional identity with certain sounds. Like there's, it comes up on this show, but the difference between, epiphat pop punk type stuff, which on the West Coast was popular mainstream music, here was kind of the weird music still in a way, even though it was popular.
Yeah.
But even more with Power Violence, where Power Violence in the Bay Area West Coast was like real deal, like tag dudes that did tagging. Like,
yeah, that truly was like a very regional micro scene.
Yeah.
And of course something I became obsessed with because it is, and it did have mystery and it was, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this stuff still happens. It's just, you don't find it as much in popular culture.
Well, I think they're, because what you were saying earlier, like the idea of a band breaking through, like a truly weird band getting mainstream attention.
Yeah.
And people would bring up Nirvana. I think that's people's go-to. I think The Offspring more than Nirvana.
All right. What about the Presidents of the United States of America?
Yeah, that's another one that's weird.
Like, listen.
Really weird.
Not a good band, but who the fuck would put those guys out now? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think same with The Offspring. Like, you look at those
weird
dudes,
bands.
Like
they're not... Totally weird bands.
The record sounds weird, too. Yeah. Nirvana. Like,
huge hit.
Yeah, Nirvana's like a no-brainer. You look at Nirvana, you're like, okay, I could see these guys can sell. I can market this.
Yeah, I mean, and then the way that... And this is the... But again, this is the time where decisions were kind of made for the culture at large by executives and record companies. Like, I just watched that documentary about Woodstock 99, and the lineup, you know, like... I was around when Korn was popular, and I remember them being popular, but I feel like I was still shocked to see 200,000 people going apeshit for Korn. Do you know what I mean?
The power of MTV back then.
Yeah. MTV. And I think that, and now it's a little bit more democratized. So it's a little flatter. In a weird way. Because there isn't somebody being like, no, you guys are going to listen to Korn. We're going to play this all the time. This is going to be on the radio. It doesn't happen as much that way.
But there are still, and maybe these are like unconscious machinations that go on, but there's still, like I knew Turnstile was going to be huge. Like I knew it was going to break through because it felt like everything was pulling towards that for years. Like it took three records to get there, but... It always felt like everything was kind of steering that towards this thing. And there was never, like, there isn't the sort of radio programmers, like, get on K-Rock. Once you get that hit single on K-Rock, other radio will pick you up, and then you can do this thing and that thing. There's not that, like you're saying, it's democratized now, so it's not the same sort of path, but there does feel like there's still, I don't know, maybe certain intangibles that you can kind of see where things just kind of...
Definitely. And I think a lot of it has to do with... timing and presentation and you know, luck is a big part of it for some people as well. But the Turnstile thing is I know this is a band that also people really hate on. But to see something like that kind of touch mainstream culture, I think, is interesting. And it's kind of cool. And it doesn't feel like it's coming from... It does feel earnest to me. Like, it feels like these are kids are making stuff they want to make. Like, they're not trying to be something that they're not, to whatever degree. Maybe that's me guessing, but yeah, it is interesting to see that. It's just, we don't see a ton of it. I mean, hardcore music is having a moment now.
I think maybe that's because things are shrinking in terms of, like, mainstream culture, where now hardcore looks a lot bigger than it did as the water levels are rising in terms of media that's out there. Mm-hmm. Hardcore as a scene, it looks a lot larger. And I think the same thing kind of happened with wrestling, too, where wrestling went from being this sort of niche part of popular culture to now being such a mainstream part of popular culture that people, like, can see how big it is. And it feels like maybe that's happening with hardcore a little bit, too.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a long period of time in my life where I never even wanted to say I was in a hardcore band to people who didn't know about hardcore, because then it's, well, what's hardcore?
Yeah.
You have to explain it. So I was always like, I'm in a punk band.
Yeah.
You know, now that's changed for sure. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you can't really, it's like spitting in the wind to try to, you don't want to also sound like an old person complaining about how things used to be better. And I don't even know that that's true exactly.
No.
But yeah, it seems a little harder to find your way to stuff. And, when you have your fingertips are able to touch everything, it's harder to find things that are special to you personally.
Yeah, and I don't think we're complaining.
No, no.
Like that's the
maybe. I don't know.
No, I don't think we're coming off as complaining. Or at least I hope we're not, because I think it's just acknowledging that there is a change, and the fact that it's almost like celebrating the fact that people still find it, people still build it, people still. There's still an underground scene. There's still DIY bands. There's still, like, a realness to it, because it is getting harder as stuff is getting less special to make something special.
Yeah, and I think the pressure builds up in terms of if culture ends up being getting more and more bland, you know, this even goes into film where Twitter will be screaming and yelling about some Star Wars character, then the studio will be like, well, we got to put that guy in the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, these idiots are like, these complete morons on Twitter are, like, deciding how films are made. It's not great. And so I think it builds up pressure where people are desperate to find something interesting, desperate to find something that's unique and weird and outside of these boundaries. So I think it does end up creating really interesting art ultimately, and I think we're starting to see that, and you always will see it a little bit, but I think it's going to be like a big explosion of cool stuff coming because of all this. I kind of long
for, like, what the reviews of Batman, or how Twitter would have reacted to, like, the 89 Batman.
They were so mad about Michael Keaton, there was no internet, but they were still just like, I'm not seeing this. People were like protesting movie theaters. Yeah. But they still did it, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Because back then you could be like, well, fuck that fan base. Like, that, who cares about that fan base? Yeah. No one's going to hear them screaming. Like
we have to get a Zack Snyder cut because these fucking bedwetters are tweeting about it.
I watched all 5 hours. And
I did too. Like, 3 times. God, it's the worst fucking thing.
Amazing.
Yeah, it just, that stuff is like, you're not in the film business. You know, stay out of this creative stuff. You're not a creative person, you know? You're like, a Little Mermaid can't be black. It's like, get the fuck out of here. You're a grown-up. You know, that stuff drives me up a wall. And that does have a direct effect on, you know, how a lot of mainstream films are made. Mm-hmm. This kind of, I mean, I think, with Star Wars, the reboot, it was so, like, trying to just cater to, like, as many possible Star Wars fans as possible. And it ends up being, like, fun for nobody, basically. And if that gets into real film culture, if that gets into, you know, interesting musical, like, that stuff is not going to be good.
But it has to, kind of, in a way. Because it does affect you. Like, the negative reviews, no matter how...
As an artist, if you read a negative review, you're like, oh, I need to...
But that's what I mean. And I think even, like, the studios, as these not in a John Kerry corporations are people kind of way, but like these studios are, their feelings are their finances, and they're like, well, if we did this, maybe it would work out this time. Like, maybe we could get the audience back if we...
Yeah, for sure. And I've definitely, you know...
And it does work sometimes.
But you have to be discerning about... If I get negative stuff tweeted to me about myself on Twitter, which does happen, yes. I'm pretty quickly it's easily discernible if it's something that is a valid critique or if it's someone who's just angry and wants to lash out about something. I don't know. I feel like crowdsourcing for stuff like this is not, I don't think it does work. When does it work?
Barbie.
You think that was crowdsourced?
I know this is a very controversial opinion. This might be the most controversial shit I've ever said on this podcast. Okay. No disrespect to that movie. The movie did obviously an incredible box office. I saw it with my kids. They loved it. Yeah. It wasn't for me in that way.
No. I don't think they had Damien in mind when they made
Barbie. But there was a reference to Kubrick, so I felt like I was served in that way. I felt like it was a movie that served the audience, and this was why it's a successful movie. Like, this is not a criticism. It served every audience that it was there for.
Yeah, well, it's not a hard and fast rule, but I have a pretty good rule of thumb. So one of the worst things that have ever been invented on Earth is Rotten Tomatoes. So if a movie is over 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, I'm like, this is not good. This can't be a good film. If it's like 70% to 50%, I'm like, there's something interesting going on here. You know, below 50, you're probably in bad territory. But in that zone, if a movie really upsets someone and then it really excites somebody else, that probably means it's more interesting than something that everyone's just kind of like, that's fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We all liked this. It's less exciting to me. So I often will avoid movies that are, you know, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Does that apply to TV series too, or is that exclusively film?
I really have, this is going to make me sound like such a grump, but I'm like narrative television, I can't think of a good narrative TV show that I've seen in the past couple of years. I just don't like there's not very, to me, I love film because it's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And a series is a beginning, a middle, a middle, a middle, a middle, a middle, and then either they get canceled or they have to come up with something. You know, nothing needs to be... I remember someone trying to tell me to get into Game of Thrones, right? And they're like, it gets good after season 3. I'm like, that's a lot of my life. So I have to watch a bad show for 3 seasons, you know?
Yeah, but how many Ed Wood movies have you seen?
Ed Wood movies? Probably 2.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like...
I've wasted a lot more
There's a difference to camp, and there's a difference to enjoying something. There's a pleasure to be had in oddball stuff, like Ed Wood and is a good example of that. But as opposed to just very sanitary television shows that just... I mean, God, I'd rather eat glass than watch Game of Thrones.
Oh, I hate Game of Thrones. But for me, I hate it because I find it just so dehumanizing, the level of violence, and I find all that stuff to it just so... And Lauren will always critique me because she was like, you watch this, you watch that.
And no,
like,
I know.
It's just, it's different how it's framed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everyone's got different opinions about stuff. And I also, you know, we've got Jerry Seinfeld is the joke that people say life is too short. He's like, life's too long. And we've got to fill in our lives with something. And I get it. For some reason... narrative television, there's very few narrative TV shows that are current that I can get down with.
Medical Detectives.
Is that a show?
It was on Netflix. It was it was the people that did Children's Hospital.
Oh, okay.
And it's very good. It's unfortunately about a pathogen and leading to a pandemic a little bit. Oh, okay. So, but it's very funny.
I mean, there's definitely stuff. I'm not going to pretend like there isn't TV shows that I watch, but I find that to be... it's one of the harder when everyone's talking about a show and then I'm like, this thing? What the fuck?
I found there was like, you're right, because I think it's changed the way people consume these things. Like,
yeah.
You're not trying to make things that are, like when you worked, and you worked at a video store, you know what it was like when people brought back that movie and they're like, this fucking sucked. And it's like, well, too bad you rented it. Like, there's no refunds for a taste.
Yeah.
That there was kind of like this, like, I committed, I'm in for this. Whereas now it feels like you're just trying to get people to like, be like, okay with it. Are you okay with it? You don't care if people love it or hate it. As long as like, it's just okay enough that it gets that 80.
Yeah. There's just this gaping maw for content. And I found that back in the day when you spend your hard earned money on a record and you're like, you put it on, you're like, oh no, this is bad. But then you're like, but I paid for this. So you sit with it, you listen to it over and over again, and you usually find something in there, you know? And I think that doesn't happen quite as much anymore. And that's not to say that you should force feed yourself bad content just because you paid for it. But
that's the thing about the bad records. These people thought they were good.
Yeah.
And I'm sure on some level, these people producing these, I guess there's so many people involved in the production of these TV shows and movies that maybe the sense of ownership isn't there in the same way.
Yeah.
But these people honestly thought these records that we thought were terrible, like, oh my God, this band's like, what the fuck is up with this Second Uniform Choice LP or this thing or that thing. These people were putting their heart and soul into it and putting their love into it and honestly did think, this is awesome. People are going to like this. They're going to respond well to how we rock.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I bought it.
I think by the time I bought it, I'm sure with you, it was already known that it was...
Yeah, but I was like, I'm like, maybe people are wrong about this. But yeah, yeah.
Like the second DYS record.
Oh, yeah. I have, yeah.
That's a good record.
I like it. Yeah, I have it. I like it.
I had this person on the other day, Devin Ross, who is signed with like Thurston Moore's label, and she's kind of blowing up in terms of like she put out the single this summer that's getting a lot of hype, and she's got a huge following on Instagram and dates Nick Cave's son, and is kind of like labeled like an it couple, and she's like an it person in fashion and things like that now. And she was on the show and it was interesting how just different the relationship to culture is that I feel now with younger people. But also she brought up that the she watched Meet Me in the Bathroom, and that was the last real scene.
She said that?
Yeah, that existed.
LOL.
And she was part, she went to smell shows. Obviously, the smell still goes on. But I think at the tail end of sort of that big first smell boom.
Yeah.
Into sort of like the dying days of mainstream alternative culture that existed. Yeah. But she pointed to that scene as being the last real scene that existed.
God.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, I think so much about enjoying culture is contextual, right? It's who you were with, how old you were, where you were, how you found it. You know, for example, I love Minor Threat. And I found them kind of on my own and just listened to them kind of in the solitary. I imagined what that world was like. I've never been to see them play. I'd never been to a show that they played. I had a friend who was older than me who worked as a bouncer at a club where Minor Threat would play. And he's like, I fucking hate Minor Threat. Those guys, those shows were awful. Those guys were awful. I worked with my boss at the video store. I was playing Black Sabbath. And he's like, oh, man. The guys who were fans of Black Sabbath, they would like call me a faggot every day. And like, I fucking hate that band. I hate their fans. And I'm watching it in a, I'm like listening to Black Sabbath in my own little void. And you create your own narrative about that stuff. And I think it happens generationally where, you know, either you're there for it and you've got an idea about it, or you weren't there for it and you contextualize it yourself. So if, you know, you weren't around for whatever she thinks that scene is, you might have imagined that it was this kind of magical thing. And yeah, that's fine. You should feel that way and enjoy it. Like that shouldn't, someone's lived experience shouldn't ruin your reality of enjoying this music or having an idea of what that scene is like or whatever, I guess. I don't know. This isn't very well thought out theory, but.
No, but it is interesting because you realize that the people that grew up next to something have a different relationship to it than the people that encountered it post it getting big.
Like the 90s revival that happened and people were like, you know who's awesome? Fucking... The Gin Blossoms or something. And I'd be like,
Gin Blossoms are fucking awesome.
No, they're not. Are they Canadian? Are they Canadian?
No.
Oh, okay.
Right. No, I think they're from Seattle.
Yeah, but I was like, they're, okay, whatever.
Gin Blossoms have some songs.
Okay, fine. But I'm saying I was, you know, as a person who lived through it, I'm kind of like, the fucking Gin Blossoms? You know,
yeah, I get it.
I'm just using them as an example.
Well, but like Korn. Korn, like people Korn, that lived through it, when people are like, you see kids in hardcore celebrating Limp Bizkit now, and it's like, that was not it.
Yeah, or
it was
also,
way better shit at that time.
Even in my local hardcore scene in Connecticut, you'll find people like fetishizing the worst bands from that scene that no one liked, and being like, I got the demo tape. I got the demo tape or whatever. Maybe I shouldn't say their name. But
I'll peep it out.
But it's one of those things where you're like, really? This, like, you know. But again, it's, you know, time recontextualizes things, and people have ideas about fantasies about that world and what it was like, and that everybody in the scene were all friends, and everybody, you know, it's just, I've certainly done it. I mean, I've fantasized about, I mean, I certainly have done it with like the Youth Crew hardcore scene or like Minor Threat, or even it's like Roxy Music and Bowie, and I'm like T-Rex. I'm like, they're all hanging out, whatever. And, you know, I'm sure that that's not true.
Maybe back then they were in the 70s when they were all like, you see photos of them all chilling together.
No, I mean, I think about like Iggy and David, like they're my friends, Iggy Pop and David Bowie. they are my friends. Like hanging out, and you're just like, these are the two coolest guys. And I'm sure they were nightmares. You know what I mean? If someone was around them, they're just on coke all the time. And I'm sure they were not pleasant, but I'm like, you couldn't look cooler. The music couldn't be cooler. It's cool. But I have no context for it beyond just looking at photos and listening to records. And I don't know.
It's interesting though, cause I think that Meet Me in the Bathroom scene might be that last geographical scene that people fetishize like that. Like, obviously, Smell kind of happened post that, and Toronto kind of has a moment in hip-hop now, but in terms of, like, rock music, because that was the end of, or maybe the explosion of indie culture, indie media, in terms of mainstream media.
Well, it's also, it's a bit, I mean, I lived through that in New York. And there was a lot of cool bands, and it was cool. But this is pulling together some disparate scenes that really had nothing to do with each other.
You're the guy that links them all, I find. Maybe not the Strokes as much?
No, I actually, I love the Strokes. I love that first Strokes record a lot, but I've never seen them live.
Your connection to Julian comes through me, when he tried to make out with me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I told you this story, right?
I don't think so.
When the first time they came to Toronto, when they're blowing up.
Yeah.
Craziest show I'd ever seen at this venue, where the Rolling Stones had played a show.
Oh, I think I do remember this.
And he tried to make out with me backstage, so there's your connection.
There's my connection.
Now there you go. Yeah. So you are the
Kevin Bacon.
The link.
Yeah, you're the Kevin link. Bacon of indie sleaze, whatever the fuck it is, what they called it. But like, you know, like the DFA stuff was completely separate from all this other, from like the yeah.
But you're the link there, right? Between Nick and...
Nick,
James.
Well, Panthers played with the IAS many times. And there was so many TV on the radio for sure. We toured with, played with, loved those guys. And there's, you know, there's lots of great bands that, like, the Liars didn't quite make the cut there, but they were one of the coolest live bands from that scene at the time. I don't know, I mean, I haven't seen the documentary. I can't bring myself to do
you
it.
You still haven't watched it?
No, I read the book.
Yeah.
I skipped the chapters about, what's that band? Kings of Leon?
How are they in it? Oh, I guess they were managed by the same.
I have no idea. I didn't really understand what they were doing in that book. But
that's like when you hear about Candlebox in the Seattle scene. It's like, really? Them? They were...
Yeah. Candlebox had some songs. yeah, so I read it on a flight. And it was pretty, I mean, I found it to be pretty funny. It's just also, it's funny to hear this kind of historical take on a thing that you were there for.
Yeah.
And everyone's got a different memory of stuff, but there's a lot of things I'm like, that didn't happen. Or, you know, it's a funny thing.
What stands out to you as something that didn't happen? Or to like, there's something, even like a band that like, you're just like that.
Well, there's like a romanticizing the trajectory of a lot of these bands. And it seems to be, comes across as kind of like, you know, whenever you read it, like, if you read a book about, or see a documentary about a musician, such a big question for me is, how did you get from zero to huge? And it's never answered. Mm-hmm. You know, they always seem to just be like, and then we dropped our demo off at Capitol and we got a 12 record deal and we're, so you never quite see the building process. Even in that Bogdanovich documentary about Tom Petty, that's like 12 hours long.
Yeah.
You see them struggling and then they're famous.
There's weird shit that always like, I question like, and that's why it's fascinating when you do finally find out how it happens, but like, how does Rage Against the Machine go from having a demo tape to being on this major label thing that just blows up? And it's, but then you find out like, oh, the tape fell into the right guy's hands here, you know, or how did the Killers get on this major label as this band that had nothing released previously? And then you find out, oh, this dude knew this guy that was producing the record. And then that's how the song kind of found its way there. But it's always, there's always a connection. Like there's nothing that really truly happens organically outside of stuff blowing up on radio.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of organic stuff in the New York scene. I mean, I guess, like the Yaz were, you know, they had like a, they made their, put out their own demo CD and it was great and people just loved them in New York and the shows were sold out and people were psyched.
It felt like internationally it happened because Julian wore the pin on SNL and the next day it was like early days of music internet. People were just like, who's this band?
Yeah.
And it just snowballed from there. But I'm sure there are more.
No, I mean, it's weird how all that stuff happens. I think I've told the story on this podcast before, but when I first moved to New York, I didn't really know anybody. And I knew a couple of the guys who were in Seisha and that band Hot Cross. And they were like, we should play music together. And so I didn't want to sing in a band at that point. It was, you know, post Orchid, or maybe concurrent with Orchid. So I played guitar, and the drummer was this guy, Greg Drudy, who used to play, he had a label called Level Plane, which put out a lot of, you know, stuff from that genre, kind of screamy hardcore stuff. And the name of the band was called She's Hit. It was named after a birthday party song. And I was like, you know, pretty much obsessing with the birthday party at that point in my life.
As one does.
Yeah.
Post hardcore phase.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Greg's like, oh, you like the birthday party and like Joy Division and stuff. I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, I love that stuff. And he's like, you should see my other band. We're playing at the Mercury Lounge.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. And I went and it was Interpol.
Yeah.
And there was nobody there. But they were fully formed. Mm-hmm. Like that, I got the demo CD that night. It's basically the first record. A little worse recorded, but I prefer it in some ways. And I was just like, oh man, I was like, Greg, this band, I feel like this band could be popular. And I mean, they were still like all in the suits and everything. Then he got fired. So
yeah,
it didn't work out for a poor old Greg Drudy.
It's like Kiss, when you hear about Kiss and you kind of like, because you now can go on websites and find out every show Kiss ever played.
Yeah, and Kenny's Castaways and stuff.
Yeah, when they put on this makeup for the first time and that. And it feels like these bands are weirdly fully formed. And
yeah.
And it's...
they can, like, out of the box feels like a completed... That there's a Talking Heads DVD. If anybody, I don't know, you could probably find it somewhere else, but it's like a documentary about Talking Heads, but it had all this extra stuff on it and it had their first show ever. And they are the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, these guys are like out of the box. Great. You know, I think that's rare, but it does happen.
Yeah. Like I was listening to Integrity and I did an interview with Aaron recently and almost like not on the first 7-inch and maybe not on those demos, but like really early on they click and it's just like certain bands find that thing.
Yeah.
real early on. But then there's other bands that, that search for it for a very long time and change over time. Like the Beastie Boys, I guess it was a short period of time, but
when they were a hardcore band first?
Yeah. Yeah. But then they found kind of, and even from where they were in the beginning to where they kind of developed as a group.
Yeah, for sure.
It is a totally kind of different sound.
Yeah, I mean, we, the new project I'm doing, Jason Green and the Jerk, we just played our first live show at this place called Baby's All Right in Brooklyn. And it was a 10-piece band. We had horns, percussion, and the music had been around for a minute. So, you know, the songs were kind of there. But yeah, we were playing like, you know, we had to, it was the weirdest first show I've ever played. You know, it had to be kind of fully formed from the get, like we weren't opening up for somebody. We were headlining a show at Baby's All Right, like for our first show.
So did you have a full record of material, or were you doing covers or what?
No, we have very close to a full record. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is going to be a real band now?
Yeah, to whatever degree it's possible. I mean, we've got some shows coming up that we're going to do. And we're going to do a couple more, two more singles on DFA and then the full length.
So is it, like at this point, what is the driving factor in making stuff for you? Like what is like, is it just to produce something, or is it to express yourself, or is it like live performance? Because, I don't know, I see this as someone who's struggling with like, what would creativity look like if it wasn't my job at this point? Like I collaborate with other people and I kind of experience it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder what my relationship would be like if it wasn't imposed upon me.
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think also we've both been in touring punk bands for a huge portion of our lives. I mean, I think Orchid started touring when I was 19, 18. I'm 45.
Yeah.
So it does seem to a degree that this is how it is for me. This is what life is like. And I constantly am trying to, that's why I'd like to do different projects too, because I do find it stimulating to work on, not on just one thing. I don't know, man. That's a question I have to ask my therapist probably.
Are you at a Rollins stage where you're like, I don't want to yell in a hardcore band anymore?
No, I like yelling in hardcore band. I mean, I love hardcore. I love heavy
music. I guess
music.
Your Orchid's back together. I'm saying Orchid this, you're like, together, yeah. Your main gig is kind of coming back again.
Yeah. No, I don't. I mean, but I did have, I did want to do, my musical tastes are myriad. So I wanted to, and a big part of my social circle are people who do, you know, weird kind of funky dance music, punky stuff. And I wanted to express that part of myself. And I like, you know, I like messing around with old synthesizers and drum machines, and a lot of that stuff just doesn't fit into the hardcore world as much. I don't know. I
mean, no, it does.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, like, it's a different kind of, like, you know, it's not, I don't want to be in the Locust or whatever. Not, no shade to the Locust. They're a great band.
No, I know. No, I didn't mean that when I laughed there, but I'm like, I'm just picturing of how you could do your MS Paint style.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Modern hardcore band.
Yeah. I think I would have to be handsome and 20 would probably be the best way to do that. And I'm neither of those things, so.
I'm glad I grew up in the era where bands like Poison Idea could inspire me, because
yes.
I think now I would be like, well, I just don't got.
There is a, I still have a thing when I see an ugly band and they're good. I'm like, nice.
Yeah.
I'm like, now I know you're good.
I root for fat dudes in bands.
Oh, of
like,
course.
Anytime there's a fat person in a band, I'm like, yes.
Yes.
Do it.
Of course. Of course. You got to support our people.
I remember seeing an interview with Phil Collins, and he's like, oh, I'd never make it now in the era of videos.
Yeah, I mean, you look at everyone in Genesis, and you're like, huh?
I was looking at Gentle Giant the other day. I was showing,
oh, God.
Like, Gentle Giant. Like, yeah, these guys were huge.
Yeah, I know. There's, yeah, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite new bands is Blood Incantation. They're like a death metal band from Texas, and they're awesome. They also, and he does, the main guy does like ambient synth stuff as a side project, like new age synth stuff. And he has an amazing look, long hair, bald on top, glasses. And as soon as I looked at him, I'm like, this guy makes good music. Like you could just, he gave off this feeling I'm like, this guy knows what he's doing, you know? And he did feel like from another era almost. And yeah, now hardcore is like, you gotta be fucking pumping weights, dude.
Yeah.
Everyone's jacked.
Yep. Everyone's got well, it's an Instagram kind of moment.
Yeah.
Raising my kids in this time, like not the younger ones, but certainly with the older ones, just how there's this sort of new thing of us just being into an aesthetic. So you could be a goth kid, but have no relationship to goth culture in terms of the music or in terms of any of the sort of history of this thing other than this aesthetic. And then there's some sub-aesthetics within that world. Or I got to be careful how much I talk about my older kid because he would not like it if I was talking about
right,
it.
Right, sure.
They're very into skincare and very into working out and just being more, and they're not even necessarily posting pictures on Instagram or anything like that, but I just feel like those pressures that we felt as kids, that people were like, oh, MTV, bad distortion of body image, those things are hyper accelerated now.
Yeah. No, I think that that's very true. I remember it seemed there was always like jacked guys in hardcore. Fury of Five, Stickman.
Yep.
But I mean, that, you know, now I felt like in the past 5 or so years, every band is fucking giant. It's like giant muscle dudes.
Yeah. There's a lot more, a lot more awareness, I guess, also about working out and just, we've got on our phones, like an Apple step counter. Like
yeah.
We're all just constantly bombarded with quote unquote health, depending on what your definition of this or stuff is. But so I can only imagine that's going to have an impact and seep into hardcore. But hardcore felt always such like an anti-aesthetic. Especially, I think the time we grew up in hardcore was part of this weird glitch in the Matrix where you look at the 70s and we talked about Bowie and Iggy and these aesthetic kind of gods that were kind of the forefront of proto-punk type thing. And even that first wave of punk where everyone's kind of very much dressed up. But we were, by the time the 90s rolled around, you could show up to shows in whatever the fuck you wanted.
No, that's very true. Yeah, that's very true. And it was definitely, and I know in Connecticut it was like there was a ska band that would play on the show and then it'd be a hardcore band and then it'd be a weird street punk band. You know, there was a lot of that stuff. And it was kind of like, especially if you come from a smaller scene or take what you, everyone come on in, you know, we want, and yeah. I mean, I dressed like a complete lunatic at those shows, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Youth
Crew, though, was...
Youth Crew was very aesthetic.
Very aesthetic.
And they're all jacked as well. They're even more so now. It's, those guys are...
Yeah, there was very much... even, like, Hardline. I remember, like, Hardline having strong man competitions and...
Yeah.
Or Hardline taking protein powder, vegan protein powder.
Yeah. You know? So much of that, you know, their the culture of Straight Edge 2 was health, you know? Like, your body is important. Your body is a temple. Like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was more of the McDonald's straight.
Yeah. I only ate French fries.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a French fry vegan.
Papa chip vegan.
Yeah.
It was a lot harder to be vegan back then.
No, for sure. I mean, I remember there was Taco Bell. You could get bean burritos. And then the only place that had a veggie burger was Chili's. It had a bean burger. It was like the only place that you could get veggie burgers. They weren't the grocery stores or anything like that.
I don't, like, this is a controversial topic in punk and hardcore these days, but the idea of, like, certainly Taco Bell's doing a lot of hardcore commercials.
Oh yeah.
These days,
yeah.
And references to hardcore and punk. I feel like that is a natural marriage in a way.
No, I mean it was definitely Taco Bell was a huge part of hardcore culture for me growing up.
Definitely a huge. Still, I think it's still when I'm on the road and I can't afford Chipotle, and I get down to the Taco Bell days of per diem. I'm grateful that they have those bean burritos.
I feel like I brought it up on the podcast before, but Panthers were sponsored by Taco Bell Bucks. We ate a lot of Taco Bell.
I meant to say we should bring Jeff on today too. Call him in.
Yeah.
On the show.
You should have Jeff on.
I know. We should. I want to have him on because, and then we can do a splits with the two of you, just roasting each other.
I'm sure he's got a lot to say.
Do you feel at peace with Panthers now? Because I feel like, no, I'm sorry. Do you feel at peace with Orchid now in a way, a different way? Because I feel like I've followed the journey that's come to this reunion just through our conversation in the last few years. And I think in the beginning, there was a lot of trepidation.
Yeah.
And maybe we even had that. I guess it was during the pandemic, I think we first started talking about that stuff, too. But you did feel like there was sort of a, I don't know, it just felt like you were, like, a little uneasy with it.
Yeah, I still am, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm still uneasy about it. And I haven't totally come to terms with it, but there was, I mean, you were big, I've talked about this in a couple of their podcasts that I've done recently, but people are asking why, what was the change of mind? But one of the things was a conversation you and I had when you said to me, do you still like those guys? And I said, yeah. And then you said, do you like the songs? And I said, yeah. And then you said, what's the problem? And I was like, that's a good point. And then our bass player, Brad Wallace, he said, you know, he was nervous about reuniting too. He's like, but I don't think on my deathbed I'm going to say, I'm glad I didn't reunite. And I was like, that's also a good point.
Yeah.
There's stuff that I'm excited about with it, and there's stuff that I'm scared about. And it's going to be strange, for sure. And I'm asking for trouble, is the other part of the story. That's the thing I'm looking forward to the least.
How do you feel you're asking for trouble?
Internet abuse.
You think?
I mean, I get it already, to some degree.
Yeah.
And it's gonna get worse.
Heavy, you think?
Yeah. And it might not always be abuse, but it's gonna be like a lot of, you know,
judgy shit.
And like memes I don't understand.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you know, I know how it is with the, no matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, people are gonna be unhappy with the venue you choose or how much the tickets are. Why aren't you playing in Albuquerque, you know, all of the comments are, why aren't you coming here? Why aren't you coming here? Why aren't you coming here? You know? And so you know that there's going to be people, you can't make everybody happy. So the idea is basically to do the best we can for ourselves to feel comfortable playing and like pick venues that, you know, do all ages shows, make sure there's no barricades, you know, try to do our best to keep tickets out of the hands of second market sellers and stuff like that. And then if, you know, if it feels, it can't be super authentic to what Orchid was because we never did shows like this before, done shows like this before. But we want to try to make it as feel as good as possible and feel as true to kind of the spirit of the band as possible.
Well, that, like we were talking about earlier, this is the way it affects art. And the way it affects the way you do things is the fact that you do hear from everyone that it's like, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? In a way that filmmakers didn't have to hear it.
Yeah.
If you made the net and people thought there was too much typing, just don't read the paper.
Yeah,
and probably the studio would tell you that it wasn't working out too
well. Yeah.
But now it's beamed into you. It's like it's going to affect you in the same way it's going to make you want to work out. If you're seeing every other kid work out and every other kid talking about it.
Well, and also, you know, I have my own, we have an Orchid Instagram page. And then I have a page that's for me, but I use it to promote stuff I'm working on. It's not like a fully personal page or anything. So it's open to the public. So people, you know, work their way from the Orchid page over to my page in the DMs. How come this? Why aren't that? You know, stuff. And I'm just kind of, I think the only DM I responded to was a kid who was doing a fanzine about Hampshire College Hardcore, who was going to Hampshire, and I was like, "Yes, I will do an interview with you." And I think that's otherwise, I haven't answered anything.
Because it's people feel a sense of ownership over things, especially things you didn't necessarily experience.
Yeah, and there's an entitlement. I think people feel an entitlement to a lot of things that they don't. Necessarily, that's maybe misguided. And also, it's, you know, I understand something's important to you. You don't want to see it fucked up either, you know, as a fan. And so I could see, I mean, if I was a fan of Orchid and then this came up, I'd be like, what the fuck, you know, maybe, you know, who knows? But I can understand people being trepidatious about it or cynical about it. You know, it's just the nature of the thing. So I think I just have to focus on it being fun for me and good and fun to spend time with the guys and play some shows.
Well, and I think I feel, at times in my life, have definitely been judgmental of things that I had no right to be in terms of other people's art.
Of course.
Looking at Ian McCaskey, like, why isn't he doing Minor Threat? Why is this Fugazi record? Like, I don't like this thing. Like, it's not my place to say. It's not my place to say that the Uniform Choice next record's like a departure record or a sellout record. It's what they were doing. It's what they wanted to do.
But you become really attached to artists, and music is a big one where things can feel very personal. It can you can hear a certain song at a certain point in your life, or breakups happening, or someone's passed away, and you get really tied to it. You know, you get really attached to it. And so when that artist does something that you don't, that doesn't fit into that picture of them, that can be upsetting. And, you know, I see it with, like, doing the LCD stuff, like traveling around with those guys. I mean, people really feel ownership over that band. And so whenever they do anything, people are like on top of it, you know? And I used to hear James complain about certain things, and I was like, come on. And now I'm like, oh, okay, I understand. I mean, also the fact, you know, he has the wine bar in Brooklyn, and I just opened up this bar in Toronto. And now through the Instagram pipeline, people know that I'm there, and I work there like fairly regularly. I'm at the bar. So I've had people come just to punish me about working at the bar. It's like a... And then I texted James. I was like, I can see why you don't work the floor at Four Horsemen. He's like, oh, never, ever would I do that. I mean, obviously he's got it much worse than me. Like, they're a huge band, but yeah. Then people feel a connection to you that they don't, you know, you don't know them. You've had that, you know, people get very passionate about certain things, and
yeah.
And then I feel a responsibility to make like sure that those interactions go okay. Like, people walk away feeling satisfied, but it's hard to know.
It's hard. And I think because I never went away, it's also different. I think the fact that people have a relationship with Orchid that developed independent from you as a person.
Yeah.
And, or maybe they followed you through other projects, but like, you were kind of, Orchid was free to kind of develop organically in people's imaginations on a certain level. And that's by never going away, people saw me get fat and old and ugly, and people saw me get stupidly embarrassing at different stages, and people really, you know, warts and all, saw fucked up decline.
No, I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who, you know, I mean, you can go on my Instagram, you can see what I look like. I mean, I'm a lot older. It's a different thing. My main trepidation has always been, am I going to be killing what's appealing about the band, the mystery, right? People's imagination of what this thing is or was or could be, just like watching YouTube clips or whatever. And that's something I want to try to maintain that to some capacity. I've got ideas about how to do it, but yeah, that's a big one for me, because there is something, like I said, with the Sparks thing, sometimes the less you know, the better.
Yeah.
And you create your own narratives, and you give these people personalities, and you give these people motivations that they may or may not have, and it works for you. And then if someone's like, no, 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 no. It's like when someone explains lyrics to a song. When someone's like, oh, you know, my mother died, and then this song really spoke to me because I can tell these lyrics are about someone passing away. And then someone's like, no, it's actually not about that. It's about, I was in a car accident and whatever. And then you're just like, what? And now the thing's ruined for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think having, letting there be some mystery to it is important, I guess.
But I think you bring up Sparks. They're from an era where you were still afforded to have that mystery. And I would love to be in a position or successful enough where you could, you know, afford not to work the floor at your bar or go on Instagram and have to be like, yo, here's what I'm doing right now. But maybe that's also why this era is, people are more into authenticity, or perceived authenticity at least, because there is that sense that you never go away now. Like, you're always going to be present with people. And so they're going to see you all the time. And in your real life and see it. But yeah, that would, I would love, holy shit. And my number it would take to walk away isn't that high. If people are sick of me, I just feel like, yo, kick in a couple bucks a month and I'll disappear forever.
Yeah, a Patreon to get me to leave.
Patreon to get me to leave.
It's not the worst idea. Yeah. People dislike me so much, they pay me money to not go outside.
There are certain people I would contribute to a Patreon to leave.
I would. There, I can think of a few.
Maybe that'll be the new thing.
It's not a bad idea.
Like the democratization of media has gotten.
Maybe such... we need a name for this specific Patreon. It's going to have its own company.
Yeah. Like the Blacklist.
No, that could be good.
I'm sure that magazine, we could probably get the name off that magazine real cheap now.
I bet. That's okay. I think it's a moneymaker.
I think it's a moneymaker. I think it might be better than trying to get people to pay for me to do things for them. It's get them to, not to do things
you
for
threaten,
them.
You threaten. You'd be like, I'm going to come to your house.
Yeah. You. They're going
to... And I'm gonna just going to talk to you.
I'm just going to come and punish you at your doorstep.
Yeah, yeah.
And clear this up. That's what I feel like anytime someone meets me. I feel like at the end of it, they come away like a little more demystified with the whole celebrity thing because they're like, wow, that's it?
That's... Yeah, it's a weird... Those are weird interactions that I don't think anybody can like live up to the expectation of... What the person, you know what I mean? I don't know. I think sometimes people are like, oh, well, we'll be end up being friends, or I'll get this from them, or that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's hard. You can't, and people have their own ideas about all kinds of stuff that you can't control. But yeah. Yeah, I think I probably have demystified a few people here.
But that's what I feel like the punk thing is also. And that's, it is a demystification.
Well, that was the whole thing. I mean, we played on the floor and I sold the merch.
Yeah.
You know, there was never this
It was
space.
Never Kiss.
No, and there was never this space between the audience and the band. And we were very much about, like, we're all the same, even though whatever. And, yeah. Yeah, but that's, you know.
And that hasn't changed. Like, you're still entertaining people that come to talk to you about your band. It's not like you've put up that wall. And I think that's the biggest thing. More than any other factor of punk and hardcore is the fact that, like, you never put up that wall.
Yeah, it's you're still an approachable person. You're, like, you're positing that we're all operating on the same level. We're all people. We should all be able to talk to each other.
And, you know, it's all bullshit and edifice. There's, like, we're all just insecure people. And yeah. Some of us found a way to, like, turn it into something. And,
yeah.
But it's... Everyone's got those same insecure emotions, sure. And the bad reviews affect the most famous people as much as it affects the, you know, kid just looking at, you know, the review of their first project.
Of course. And I mean, I think, I don't know if you have this, but I have this gift for even if the review is almost entirely good, if it feels like there's one shady line in it, I'm like, and that's all I can focus on.
Yeah, of course. Of course, there are reviews and lines that I've been tempted to write into lyrics for years. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I should address that critique in a song.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Like, do you think?
Yeah. I do like the idea of having my friend has a bar in Brooklyn called Doris. It's a great bar in Bed-Stuy. And he made coasters that had their lines from their worst Yelp reviews on it. It's like too loud, too crowded. It's like really funny. I do like that kind of like leaning into some of that stuff a little bit, but it's hard to do it without seeming, you know, petty, obviously.
It is. And it's hard to just be in a band and not be petty. I remember reading in a Sonic Life fanzine, as we were talking about before we went on air, the Sonic Youth fanzine, this interview with Pavement, and they were talking about how someone wanted tickets and it was someone who was super mean to them in high school. And just being so stoked to, like, deny them getting them tickets on this thing. And they're sort of... And I remember reading it as a kid being like, oh, my God, one day.
I'll be able
to do this and not be petty when this whole thing was built on pettiness to begin with.
I know. Yeah. That is funny. I mean, I've certainly had fantasies like that. But of course, the people who were mean to me in high school have zero interest in any of that.
They were never into cool shit.
They were not gonna. They're not gonna be interested now. They weren't then.
Unless you're Nirvana, they're not really gonna come down.
I'll have to like go to a reunion and be like, "Guess what, guys? Like, bring my records. Make them watch YouTube clips."
I would. I know people like go to reunions. I know it's such a part of pop culture.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine why the fuck would I want to go to a reunion?
I went to one. I went to my 5-year because I was home and my two buddies, Jeff Garlock and Eric McManus, who I played music with, All I Ask with, they were going to go. And I was like, so I just went on a whim and I was like, worst idea. Worst idea. It is a trope, though. It's once you get successful, then you go back to your high school reunion. But now I'm like, we're at our like fucking 35th high school reunion or something.
Like now it's really sad. Now it's like catching up on.
Yeah, everyone's just like, dying and stuff.
Yeah, it's not a good time. The romantic part of this, I'll get them when, is long since passed.
Yeah, no one cares.
Now it's just regret.
Yeah, and no one cares at all.
This is where my life's at.
Yeah.
But your life, you're way better at adulting than I am. So, you know what? Hats off to you.
I'm better at adulting?
Yeah. Well, I've got the kids, obviously.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's pretty adult.
Yeah.
It's pretty adult.
Not if you ask them.
I don't know what I'm doing.
I think you're doing great.
Thanks, buddy.
Congratulations on the new record.
Thanks.
And congratulations on the reunion.
Yeah.
Congratulations on the bar.
Thank you.
My gosh. It's a huge year.
Three things all happening at the same time. Not my plan. Meant to spread them out.
But this is what they call a drop in the biz.
It's a lot of drops.
You're doing a lot of drops this year.
It's a lot of drops. It was supposed to be a drip, but it turned into a drop.
Thank you, Jason, for coming on the show. And you're right there. Jason will be back at some point in the future for more hanging out in the basement. Best place in the world. Weird smells, but a lot of cool stuff to look at. Check out Jason's stuff, as I mentioned off the top. And speaking of things to check out on the next episode from the amazing Legends L7. Jennifer Finch is on the show for, dare I say, one of the all-time episodes of Turned Out of Punk. And I can't wait for you to hear it. And that is coming out on the next one. So much good stuff in that episode. It's exciting. That's the end of the show. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect their rights and their safety. Stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths, different races, different nationalities, because we're not talking about politics. It's just basic human rights. People deserve to be able to live free from hate, violence, and discrimination. If there's organizations that are affecting positive change in your world, get involved. Donate your time, donate your money, because it can feel better when you get involved. And speaking of getting involved, start a band. Start a punk band. Anyone can do that shit. Start putting on shows, start making flyers. Just do something in the punk scene, to quote Tony Urba. Paraphrase Tony Urba. And because the scene gets better when you get involved. Speaking about things that need your involvement, donate your organs, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. And I've seen the miracles they perform. Sign your organ donor cards where you can. And try meditating. It works for me. Maybe it'll work for you. It took me a long time to work for me. I didn't believe in it. Like, you know, people have been doing this thing for centuries. But I didn't really believe in it. Now, you know, it works. And there's no specific practice that I'm pushing on you. Just try breathing and shutting off your brain a little bit. Well, that's me. That's it for me. I'm going to shut off my brain now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Stay safe.